interesting aspect of the demo. I'm going to go through a little introduction of morphing, and then the problem that we're trying to solve going into our implementation from a tool standpoint and a runtime standpoint, and then there's some conclusions that we came to. So everyone here knows what morphing is. It started off with 2D morphing, where you're going to take a domain on one texture and map it to a domain on another texture. An artist just manually says, this feature goes to this feature, and then you can do some kind of transformation from one to the other, usually a linear transform. And that could be extended to 3D, where we're talking about vertices and we're moving from one to the other. What we wanted to do here was a little different. All these 3D type of morphing techniques required you to have meshes that were very similar, from a bone count, from a skeleton count, from a vertex, a mesh standpoint. So we wanted to do something which would be interesting inside of a demo. So what are the trade-offs for doing this? Well, when you have lots and lots of bones, that's lots and lots of computation. There's a lot of things that you have to calculate. If you don't have enough bones, then it looks pretty bland. It looks very artificial. Now, same thing with vertex counts. To get interesting morphs, you need a lot of vertices around. And when you don't have it, you see the little bends, and you see stuff that you really don't want to. And we're now in the age of complex shaders. We're not talking about just applying a texture map from one model and a texture map to another model and just doing a linear transform between the two of them. We're talking about complex things happening at the pixel level. And one of the things when you're doing morphing is well, what happens when you totally transition from one to the other with this visual pop? We didn't want to have any kind of pop. We wanted it to look very natural going from one character to another. So our problem, what we wanted to solve here, was morphing very unique and different skeletons. We didn't want to be limited by this character has, you know, is a biped, has two legs. This character has four legs, and not being able to morph between them, not being able to have some kind of mapping. So we wanted them to be very unique. We wanted to have very different types of bone counts. I'm going to be showing a demonstration, and all through my talk, the bone counts that we're using is between 40 and 60 per character. So it varies a lot. And we needed really high-quality results. And by this, what I'm talking about is going to the next point of pixel shading. We wanted it to be able to combine these different effects, combine the morphing with some cool things happening underneath it. There's been some talk today about hair, and we're doing a variant on that of fur on some of the characters, and some of the characters don't have it, and morphing between those two extremes. So we wanted to be able to do this in real time and make it look interesting. So we came up with some conceptual artwork for what we wanted these characters to look like from the very beginning, and you'll see that we came pretty close to these characters. The main thing, and you can't really see it on the second one on Scut, is that he has six legs, and all these other guys have four. It's not coming out in the picture, but basically that's the essence, that these have very different skeletal structures. Now, when we're talking about morphing, this is our data structure here. This is what we're going to be sending around to the vertex shaders, is just positional information and normal information, and then also some tangent space values. Now, this is to work with our directional light and hemispherical lighting, these two other terms. Now, some of the limitations that we ran into, or we were thinking about, is that originally, we wanted to have this totally automated, that we can have the artist model something, press a button, and they get the result, the morphable character. We're not quite there yet. And we'll go into a lot of the steps that we have to go through to do this. But we also wanted the characters to have very different surface properties. Like I said, some of the characters have fur, some of them don't, some of them have what we're going to refer to as iridescence, but it's actually pseudo-iridescence, and we'll go into that. And one of the other limitations is it's still fill-bound. We are not really bound on the transformation, we're not really bound on the morphing, we're bound on the rendering. So when I'm going to talk about the implementation, I'm going to go into these different areas of actually modeling it, what the morphing constraints are going to be, how we went through load balancing the approach. The demonstration that we showed at GDC was doing it one way. What I'm going to be showing you here today is doing it another way. The demonstration at GDC was CPU bound, or actually using the CPU to do a lot of the operations. Here we're using the GPU. And we also want to do non-uniform morphing. We don't want the characters, all the vertices, to act similar. We want to be able to control on a vertex basis. And we want to apply fur over the skin and how, you know, we went about doing that. And, of course, if we have fur, we have graphical environments now. They have to be lit. So what are those properties going to be? And then how do we get this all to come together? What is our process? Now, for modeling, since we wanted to have this morphing between very unique characters, the first question is, well, how are you going to do this? What is the mapping going to be? There has to be some kind of mapping from one to the other. And we came up with the idea of the Pokey model, and we'll talk about that in a second. I want to go through and show a wireframe of each of the characters so you can see how this Pokey model fits into the scheme of the each of the different characters that you're going to see. And then from a material standpoint, from the morphing aspect, what we needed to do. There's a lot of different effects going on there, but how do we get that to act with morphing? So the Pokey model. Now the concept here, originally I went to my team and I said, here's what we want to do. We want to have morphing of these very different looking characters. I wanted the bone counts to be very different. And they said, you're crazy, you can't do that, you need the same bone counts, because blah, 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 and all these things need to fit together. So we said, no, let's look at it from a different way. How would we do this if we didn't have the same bone counts? So we came up with the idea of a Pokey model. A Pokey model is a model that has a bunch of vertices on it. It's a very dense model. And then we have the artist create assets, their models, totally in isolation of the other models and the Pokey model. And then what we do is we shrink wrap those models onto the Pokey. So we take the Pokey model, we duplicate it n number of times. We model a bunch of different characters, and then we shrink wrap each one of those different characters onto the Pokey model. So then morphing this turns into this exercise of going from one Pokey model that's been shrink-wrapped to another Pokey model that's been shrink-wrapped. So here's a wireframe of one of our characters. You can see, I can't do the mouse, in the middle of the character, there seems to be like a dense area of vertices, and we can see it more in some of the other characters. Well, this is our Scott, one of our other characters, and he has the six legs. Another one of our furry characters, and then you can see it more pronounced on this picture, that dense area in the center of the character. Now, all of these things were shrink-wrapped onto the Pokey mesh. Now, that dense area right there is where all these vertices are collapsed together. So when we're doing morphing into Scut, into the crab-like character, those vertices are going to be pulling out. So the way we went about this demo is we have this single mesh, and some of the areas are going to be compressed, some of them are not. So materials, we're looking at this from the standpoint that everything has to be per pixel. We have normal maps on these things. We have specular terms. We have lighting. all this stuff is happening per pixel, so we wanted to be able to morph between these different things on a per pixel basis, which means that we're going to be doing operations in the vertex shader according to morphing, and we're also going to be doing different types of operations in the pixel shader to do morphing. So essentially, you can think about it as we're running a shader twice, interpolating the results to get our final answer in the pixel shader. One of the other things I wanted to talk about here is that we are using texture maps for doing masking of different things, where different lighting is going to happen. And when we go into fur, we'll talk about more ways that we're using masks. So the iridescence. I want to apologize to the ATI folks here. This is not real iridescence. We're just using sphere mapping of this texture onto the characters to give it a kind of iridescence look. But this is not real iridescence. Now, what were the constraints for doing our morphing? Well, first of all is the Pokey model. We had to make it so that it was dense enough, it had enough information to map to all of our different characters. And we did this through an iterative approach. We basically came up with a Pokey model, and then we applied it to shrink wrap the different models onto it. And when we didn't have enough detail, we just went back to that Pokey model and put more detail into it, more vertices, tessellated a little more. So that was our iterative approach there. So there needed to be a one-to-one correspondence between vertices for these different meshes. And that was all handled automatically by the shrink wrapping. One of the constraints was the number of constants we needed for doing the shaders. When we're doing the skinning, there is a lot of bones there. And those bones all need to be in constant space. This was the main reason, I'll go into a second, the main reason why we did the transformations in software for the GDC demonstration. And one thing that we did with our fur was we used a shell approach. So we extruded out geometry to do our fur. We used a different density mesh for the fur as opposed to the base level, the base model. And this is something, again, we didn't do that for the GDC demo, but we did it for this one, or we're starting to do this for this one. So more on the constraints. The way this morphing is working is that we are taking a mesh. We are then animating it. So we are doing some kind of run back of an animation on different channels. And then we're going to morph the results of that. So what that means is that we're sending down two skeletons to the shader. And we're animating both parts of those skeletons and then morphing the results of those together to get our final output. And then also down in the pixel shader, we are sending down two sets of information, then running our operations, doing a morph there, and getting the final pixel results. Now, this is where that constant limit came up. And so for GDC, what we had to do is do it in software. So we had the CPU was doing all the transforms, and then we've taken the results and then doing the operation there. What we've changed for this demonstration is we broke it up into batches with certain constraints, and those constraints were information about the edges and vertex counts and which bones they were using, work on that batch, and then send out another batch. So this approach is totally GPU from the morphing aspect, whereas a GDC was not. So the load balancing, I'll just talk about this. What we really wanted to do, and this also came out, what we're showing here is obviously on a PC, with high-end graphics card, but we've done this process on other consoles, on the PlayStation 2. And dealing with the vector units, you need to have much smaller batches of information than you could on a PC with, you know, a lot more space. So this lended itself very well to how we would need to do this on the PlayStation. And I'll talk about some other issues that other tweaks that we did for the PlayStation. Now, for non-uniform morphing, what I talked about before is that we wanted to be able to morph the characters at different rates. Different vertices would act differently. And we did this by passing down information to the shaders to specify when you wanted to do this. And we did this in the color channel. Actually, we used the red aspect of one of the color channels. But we didn't want it to be uniform. So we wanted to be able to have the range be very different per vertex. And then we also scale and bias it into a certain number space.
What do you mean by
I'll go into that. Okay. Now, this is just a little graph of showing what our non-uniform morphing is. Basically, the information that we're passing down in the vertex channel is this delta that tells us when to start the animation and then how long it's going to last. Now, what that allows us to do is to have this control over per vertex way, but it also introduced some issues where now we had to actually clamp the ranges because it's not going from 0 to 1. And what I want to show you is this is a model rendered with just showing that information, and the black parts are going to morph first, and the red parts are going to morph later on. So by having the artist work in color space and model this with, you know, this painting on it, we can control how this morph is going to happen in real time. Now, we can also send down different color channels, you know, to set up a different stream if we wanted to change how one character would morph one time versus another time. This gave us a lot of flexibility. And then one of the other characters, in this one, the feet would be morphing first before the head or the upper body here. And then here is an example of a character that is morphing out of the monkey and into the crab, where his feet are, you know, different than the other body, the upper part of the body. Now, this is because we are morphing two characters at the same time through the different shaders. Now, part of the other thing that we had on our models is we had some things that really didn't map from one character to another. So we called them kind of accessories and put things into the model, into the data, that allowed us to add additional effects. There are fins and spikes on one of the models. So that is a separate object, a separate part of a mesh. It's not on every mesh. And we turn that on and off. So those happen from starting from inside of the body and morph out, so you don't really see them. So we can pop them on and off. And then the fur itself. Like I said, we added a mesh on top of the morphing mesh, which attributed the same actions where we're deforming it through morphing, but that was a separate mesh on top of it. So the basic idea of how we did the fur is we have this base model, this morphing model. We have a texture which defines where the hair follicles are going to be. And now this texture is tileable, so we're going to tile this over the object. Then we have a texture which basically is an unwrap of the model to say what the color, is going to be on this hair. So this controls the color. And in the alpha channel, we have information about how thick, the density of the hair. And then we had another map which basically said where on this character has hair at all, and where would the base color, the base information, this show through. So we had a lot of different controls for the fur on the character. and then the final result of that composite. You'll notice here, like on his chest, there really isn't hair. On his fingers, there aren't hair, but on the rest of the body, there are, and that was controlled by that alpha channel. Now, the drawing of the hair was costly in terms of fill. Now, the way we go about drawing these meshes is we extrude out the fur mesh a number of times, a number of steps, and this all is controllable by the program. And this information is then passed down into the shaders to be acted upon. So one of the level of details, one of the tunable parameters we had was this number of shells. And the program adjusted to that. This is one thing that we use in the PlayStation, is to get a whole bunch of these characters up, we can tune this number. And all of these shell layers are being alpha blended. Basically, we are modulating and controlling the alpha value of each one of these layers, tapering it off as you go further out to give it more of a hair-like look and tapering off. And the last point I want to make here is that this was the major cost in render time was drawing the hair, and it kind of dwarfed out the other aspects of doing the actual morph. Now, this is not in the demo I'm going to show you. This was in our GDC one. I just didn't get around to putting this in here. But what we had in the demo was some basic dynamics. I think someone said in one of the talks today that you have fur and it just sticks out and doesn't look very natural. Well, we saw that same thing. We added a little bit of dynamics to it to add a factor of gravity, to pull it down, to add motion by tracking from frame to frame the difference in motion, and then tweaking the hair a bit each frame so that it had a natural flow for when the character has a tail and it was flapping up and down, that the hair would kind of follow that. Now, this only works in very constrained areas. We kept the hair very, very short because we don't handle the interpenetration problem. But for our situation, for short hair on our characters, it gave it that natural look. Now, we went into then how are we going to light this thing? How are we going to make it look realistic? We used the idea of varying the lighting from the different shells that we were drawing, and the inner ones being more opaque and darker, and the outer ones being more translucent and lighter, and varying that from the shader. Just going to go through a little bit of the lighting. It's very simple. We didn't get really complex here. The only thing was that the hair itself doesn't have normals. There isn't a normal for the hair. I mean, there's like an infinite number of normals. So basically pick the best normal from the lighting direction and use that in our formulas. And then for specular, again, very standard. The only thing that we did weird here is we did a very artistic approach. We implemented it and we tweaked the values by adding in the N.L from the model into the formula from the actual hair, just to get the light to look right. It just looked very unnatural. So basically, we just tweaked the formula. We just played around with it until it looked right. I can't even tell you the exact number of times we went through this. But the idea was that we wanted it to look right. We didn't care about if it was mathematically correct. And this is basically what I was talking about. The idea of our lighting is that we kept it a very simple lighting environment, and we had basically a directional light, hemispherical lighting going on, and then we had rim lighting on our characters to keep it very simple. Now, to make this all happen, we had to go through a whole bunch of steps. And these are basically some of the tools we created to allow us to do this kind of morphing. The main one being our first tool, the thing that allows us to wrap one model onto another. And basically, what we the package we were using was 3D Studio Max. And that allowed us to write a bunch of scripts and plugins to do all these transformations. We needed to create tangents for all the vertices. We needed to be able to take a texture map, which is how the artists were actually doing the non-uniform morphing, and map those into color channels. So basically, we wrote a tool for that. One of the problems was that all these characters were created in isolation. They have different texture seams. They have different items dealing with texture mapping that we needed to get across all the models. So we basically had to write a tool that merged all these UV channels together to set up the morphing. And then later on down the line, the last tool was to basically undo that for the single model. So we needed to bring them together to form a transformation, and then we needed to undo that for each individual model. And the middle tool is our exporter. We started with, we've been doing game development for a while, we've been using Max for a while, so we started with our regular exporter and then added some more capabilities to it. But what our exporter allowed us to do was to grab vertex information, grab a whole bunch of parameters, expose them so our other tools can then merge them together, manipulate them to create the mesh. A very, very standard type of output. So we were lucky to be able to base things on that. The last thing I want to point out about this is that none of these tools are spectacular or amazing. The reason I have this slide is to point out that there's a bunch of steps that we needed to go through to get this to happen. And this is one of the things that we're working on right now, is how we can automate all of this, how we can combine these together so we can get that push button. We're not there yet. From the art pipeline, we needed to pre-plan a lot of things. We needed to say, okay, here's the characters we want to do. What are going to be the limitations? We had to go through that iteration of the Pokey model to make sure we had enough detail in it. But once we did have enough detail, then you can map any kind of mesh onto it. But it was getting to that first step. And our shaders, the thing about our shaders is they required a lot of information. We are doing two morphs at the same time and then doing the results, so you had to know what was going on there. From the pixel shader standpoint, we have a whole bunch of different variants. Are you doing morphing? Are you not? Are you have iridescence on? You're not. I'm going to talk about in my demonstration in the slides, but we are also doing shadows on there, self-shadowing, shadow maps. So is he in shadow? Is he not in shadow? I mean, these types of things we needed to enumerate out in our shaders and attach the proper one on for doing the operation. And also, when the character is morphing, it's running doing this two operation, these two transformations, and then morphing results. When he's not morphing, it goes back to just doing a single channel of stuff. So we needed all these different variants. So basically, what we got out of this was a way of morphing unique characters, was a way of allowing the artist to create their data and basically be able to then have them transform from one to the other. And it works on the current generation hardware, and we were gearing it towards the next generation. So it is usable today. Like I said, the art pipeline is our major concern right now. How do we automate that? How do we get that to work much better and more efficiently? And how can we basically package that up? And it is in use today. We did a demonstration when Microsoft showed it, and we are actually having this in our game engine now. So this is real. just wanted to give thanks to the ATG folks at High Voltage for doing all the work on this technique and demonstration, and for the artists. And like I said, this was work we did for Microsoft, so I wanted to give them a special thanks. And then I want to show you a little bit about the demo. Okay, so this is one of the characters. And here he is transforming from one character to the other. And basically, if we go back, that's one of the bugs in the program. The fur doesn't have the proper color channel information. So you're seeing it not attached actually to the body. But that's a data thing. What I wanted to show here is how those legs grew out of kind of nothing of the character. And that's one of the tricks of this technique. And then, like, this character, he's one of the furry guys, where he's transitioning from a guy who wasn't furry. And like I said, the way we're doing these types of transformations is that the fur can be turned on and off, and it morphs out from nothing to full length. And we can do that by adjusting the shaders. And then here's a character that has the teeth and the fins. Let me zoom out a bit. And so what we're doing there is we were running two different shaders, two different pixel shaders there, and interpolating the results of those pixel shaders to get these different effects. And I guess it's hard to see on here the self-shadowing of the character and on the legs. But that was part of the shaders connecting onto the proper shader at that time. So that's basically the demonstration. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Yes, actually, good point. You notice on the Pokey model, it had six legs, and most of the characters didn't have that. We wanted that detail for those legs when it did actually go into the morph. So we created the Pokey model to kind of be a superset of all the other models. It didn't have to be a direct correlation to it, but we wanted to have the same types of details. We wanted to have a head. We wanted to have legs. We wanted to have it in the basic proportions of the model so we can get the best surface area to vertices. So that's kind of what dictated how we designed that model. If you were doing very different stuff, like, you know, we're saying we can morph any kind of character into any other kind of character. Well, that's true in concept. In this demo, we made a Pokey model that worked for the set of four models that we had. If we were to add something which was on a totally different scale, we may need to adjust that Pokey model. And that's what we did throughout the demo, is go back to that Pokey model and add detail and add information when we needed it. Or more of the time it was, we looked at the results and we said, this little area here doesn't look right, probably needs more vertices, probably needs more information. And so that's what we went back and modified.
Actually carrying the model forward. I was wondering, did you tag any of the particular parts in the Pokemon model saying,
These are the lanes used for locomotion?
No. There's no information in the PokeModel at all. It's basically an instrument for doing mapping. So all the control for morphing is either happening inside those color channels or inside the animation itself. The reason why we did things the way we did is so that we could apply any type of animation to it. It didn't have to be uniform between them because the things are being animated independently of each other. So no, there is no information.
Are you always drawing the same number of vertices?
Yes.
All the time?
And, yes. It
morphs from the center. Is that because of these clusters that you said were placed in the...
It morphs according to the vertex information, the vertex colors. So actually, for different characters, they're morphing differently. So it's not uniform across the different models.
So is it morphing from one point on one of the creatures to another point on the creature it's morphing to, or via the actual...
We are animating both meshes. So think about it from this way. You have two meshes being animated, two different positions, and then we're applying that vertex information to say how much of one should we use and when does it start, and then we're just doing linear interpolation between those two poses in the shader.
I had one quick question. When you were talking about the PokeModel, it seems like, for a production standpoint, it would be nice to just have them create all the models and then have some process that statistically analyzes the models and comes up with the supermodel. Had you gone any ways towards research?
That's where we're going right now.
Okay.
The idea was that creating this PokeModel was time-consuming, and also... Part of our process does, like the texture coordinate gathering and then breaking up, goes over the whole data set. So the input to that process is all the models that you're working with, do an operation, and then apply that to the mesh. We're looking at the same type of thing for the PokeModel, where it can take all the vertices, do an operation, figure out what is that superset, what should it be mathematically. We haven't done it yet. We're kind of in the process.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask a little bit more about the UV remapping that you guys were doing. I sort of understand if you're basically drawing the mesh once and you're using the interpolation to tell you where the vertices are, then I can see that you want everything to be in a common UV space. But then you talked about splitting them back into their own spaces again, and I didn't understand what was...
Yeah,
that
maybe
was.
I misspoke there. We basically do that operation to eliminate the seams so we can get... a proper mapping, but then for each model, we only keep its own UV. So that other process, just kind of, let's look at it as a filter. It's taking those other UVs and just throwing them away because we don't need to send them down all the time. So it's not really doing operation to them. It's just removing them from the data because we put them in there to do that merging. It's kind of a housekeeping task.
Okay.
For like Max, just so you can
have. Yeah.
Another question.
I kind of understand the way that the vertices, that you've created this mannequin model, same number of vertices, and this allows the vertices to be mapped. How do the vertices, the associations between vertices and bones work during this?
There is no association between bones. That was kind of the thing we were trying to do here, is it removes the bones from the equation totally, because you're animating, maybe I didn't say that correctly in the talk, we're sending down bones for both skeletons to the shader. So both animations are happening at the same time inside the shader. Actually, in the paper, I kind of talk about it a little more, where the shader has two calls to a transform function in the morphing case. So we're doing things, and there's the last parameter on that is an offset into the constant tables, you know, where those bones are. Mm. So what the amount of bones that one person has counted to the amount of bones another person has could be totally different. The mesh itself, the vertices themselves, have a mapping. So wherever that final output from running that animation through is going to put that vertex, it's going to put another vertex in another position, and then we're going to linear interpolate those two positions.
Right. The second question was that these meshes, they are all basically sphere, topologically equivalent to spheres. Mm-hmm. You couldn't... say, use this to morph from a sphere to a torus, for example?
You're talking about like interpenetrations and stuff where we have folds?
Yeah, I mean, your vertices are fine, but the edges, can you reassign the edges on the fly to be able to change?
This technique doesn't do that. What it does is maps those vertices, so you could get situations if you had very different types of models that, you know, convex and concave implementations. I'm sure you can get vertices to start going the wrong way. But that wasn't one of the goals that we were trying to solve, but that is a problem.
Casey.
So I had a question about why you were actually sending down both copies of the skeleton to do the morph. Because, like, it doesn't actually seem like you ever need to do that. I mean, the only time you'd ever need to do that is if you pretty much could guarantee that the number of different combinations of bones used by vertices between the previous model and the new model, like, exceed the number of both skeletons' bones added together. Which, like, you can tell just by looking at this, it, like, would never do that. It just wouldn't even be close. So it seems like you'd just, like, pre-compute all the combinations. Like, you just look at both models and go, okay, here are all the combinations of bones that are used. And there's probably, like, I mean, looking at that, it probably looks like there'd be, like, 90 or something like that. And then you just compute those and send those down. That way you don't have to do two skinnings inside the vertex shader. I mean, doesn't that, like, seem like the way to do it?
Our approach was to say that there shouldn't be a limitation here. I mean, this is implementation. We can send down any number of bones. This may not be representative of what we're actually doing. The idea was that we didn't want any ties to bones. So we didn't want to come up with a superset. We didn't want to figure out all the different combinations. You can just pass down two pieces of information and get a morph from one to the other. So I wouldn't say your approach is wrong. That's not the one we were trying to solve here. What we wanted to do is not have a bone limitation on the characters. And the reason why we did the two morphs, you know, sending down information, is to guarantee that there isn't any kind of relation there, and that we could work on a subset of bones for a model, but two different models at the same time.
Right, but I mean, so do you actually know that that's ever used? I guess what I'm saying, because it certainly doesn't look like it, right? It looks like you could easily go, okay, you know, these vertices were all assigned to this bone, and then the other model, they're all assigned to this bone, and so there's just that one pairing, and we just have to compute that once at the beginning, you know, of the frame, and we're done. We don't have to actually do the full skinning pass for, like, that vertex on both skeletons, which is like doubling the shader time, you know, in some sense. Do you know what I'm saying?
Isn't that like n squared in the number of initial characters?
No, because each, like, you only care about the pairings. Like, never is like the thing on the vertex on the end of that left got, like, tentacle thing there, ever going to use the bone from, like, the tail of the previous model. So it's really, like, a very thin banded thing. Like, you're not, it's not even remotely n squared, which I guess is why I'm saying, like, it's, like, for this demo, I could guarantee that you'd, like, you know, you'd be a win there, right? So it seems like unless you're planning on doing something like super crazy, where it's just like, you know, blob of jello guy morphs into this thing, maybe, I don't know, or something, it doesn't seem like it's a win to do it that way.
The reason why we were doing this was actually research for doing next generation characters. And that was some of the guiding thoughts that went into it, is that these have to be totally isolated. But for this demonstration, could we have done it? Probably. We probably could have done this a different way, with a different method, and maybe that's another way we can look at it. But for what we want to be doing with this process, we didn't want to have that limitation. We didn't want to have to figure that out.
Just going to reiterate one tiny part of your talk to make sure I understand and then ask a question based on that. You guys allow the artist to paint the order in which the vertices weight or blend.
Yes.
And then map that onto vertex color so that you can send
yes.
it out as a stream. Did you look at using vertex texture to do that instead and just use a really low res? Because if you looked at your original, you know, ordering mm-hmm. weighting, you could super low res that texture.
Yeah, and again, that was just a demonstration of the technique. Really, where we were going with this, we wanted very different types of animations to be happening from the morphing aspect. We were thinking about spikes and things coming out of characters at different rates. But this was a very tunable approach from the artist standpoint.
They so you wanted per vertex control, and the, the vertex texture would have to be too high res.
That was kind of the goal for this, is was per vertex, per pixel, everything.
Right. Can you get the demo to get it to sit in between two of them, or does it always
work? No, actually, I can. I can.
And Casey's dying to know why it's called the Poke model also. It was driving him nuts back here.
It comes from Gumby, and it was a little pow Pokey, and just stuck inside during development. And it seemed to fit pretty well, but there's no deeper meaning there. He's just going slow. Actually, I'm not sure what he's doing right now.
Is it optimized to go from one model to another, or is it an N-squared combination?
Yeah, it can't be, because the idea, and this actually came up in the GDC talk, was that any character could go to any character at any time, so it can't be optimized for any particular way. We did this for, and there you can see the bug really well. We wanted it to be so that you can control this from a game standpoint. So there shouldn't be any kind of dependencies there. But to say that, could you make it optimal if you knew that you were going from a fur to a fur, or if you knew you're going from something with iridescent to something with iridescent? Yes, you could. We can send, we cache certain information, but we can do some more.
So when you're actually doing the blend from one character to the next, I'm just trying to understand this. So suppose that you have a guy who's crawling along the ground, and you're animating, you're interpolating to somebody who's up on, who's in a very high pose, walking off the ground. Now, do you actually have the animation synchronized so that there is an animation which takes one of the sets of bones roughly to the other set of bones, or is that interpolation just done by moving the vertices? Because it seems like you could get into a situation where, you know, in order for this character to morph to this other character, I have to make the high character's legs be on the ground for a while because his body hasn't turned yet. Because now, otherwise the vertices would all be stretching up and then down again.
Yeah, there is no control in the program for doing that. It's basically doing the vertex-to-vertex morph. We didn't want to have a restriction that you have to play this animation to go to this. So yes, you could get some weird results if you're not thinking about the range of motion, or maybe saying when you can do a morph. I mean, we actually do control the morph somewhat in the demo. We say when you're doing a morph, we don't let you do another morph in the demonstration, just because we didn't want to solve the blending issue. But that is an easy problem to solve. We just didn't want to do it right now. But we did, for the GDC demo, we actually did add additional information, different animations when they were going through the morph from an artistic approach, just to show that it's really, you know, this character doesn't want to morph and you're forcing him to, so he kind of does these different kind of actions. But that was just from an artistic approach.
And the shaded morph order mesh with the brighter red and the darker
That, each model has its own set, so you can say like
not one set per possible transition, just one set to get out of who I am.
Yes, there's only one on each model, but see, like I said before, they were vertex streams, so we can attach a different stream if we wanted it to act differently. In the demonstration, we only have one for each of the characters, but nothing stops us from having n number of them and just saying, which one do we want? Because maybe we were actually doing this in the demo early on, is we wanted the characters like to morph from the center out, both directions. And then we wanted to have his head come in and go out. The slide we had with the legs of Rex and the body of Scott showed a different type of transition. All of those were done through different vertex streams, a different texture map, a different data for that.
Yeah, hi, just a question about the Pokey model, I guess. There was an interesting paper at SIGGRAPH this year that was looking at something similar in that meshes of different topology and how you would morph between them. And one of the approaches that they went with was to use the medial axis transform, which is sort of like a lowest common denominator that captures the morphology of any mesh. So they took two different medial axis transforms, morphed between those, and then for the intermediate poses had sort of correspondences between the mesh and the MAT. I don't think that's appropriate in this case, but in the generation of the Pokey model, it seems to me that the medial axis transform might be a good way to go, in that branches in the MAT graph sort of correspond generally to articulations in the model. You know, so, you know, armatures or legs, and mm-hmm. you've got a lot of control over the MAT and how you create it as well. It might be worth having a look at.
Yeah, I think the way we did it here, and this is like the one takeaway point, is that you wouldn't want to do it this way from an art standpoint, from a art pipeline standpoint, because there was just too many steps. But we're looking at different methods now, like we were just talking about before, of actually creating an intermediate. Is there a better way? So I would say probably that's a good thing to look at. Oh, good question. N, he's going a little fast. N for this is 20.
Wow.
I didn't mention this. I said I was going to. On the PlayStation, I've brought N down to about 8. And for the life of me, maybe it's because of the TV, I couldn't really tell the difference until you go up really close. When you go up really close, then you can see the discrete steps. But I would say this is one of the things, and I alluded to this, this is one of the things we were using for LOD, is really the fill rate comes when you're really close to the model, when that's when you want the highest value of N. But still, if you have a bunch of these characters and they're in the distance, why not make them lighter weight and adjust your N value? This is 20. It looks good with 8 at the same distance.
I have a question. So you've got your morph sort of timing factors, and they're per character. Do you use the character you're morphing from, or is that a character you're
morphing to?
Morphing to.
Yes. And they are per vertex per character.
Right. It looks like you didn't do texture morphing. Was there any reason for that?
We are actually morphing the pixel shader results. So we are figuring out what those different pixels are going to be for the two things, and then linear interpolating those results. So we're not doing anything with the texture per se, unless the pixel shader is just a pass through for that.
Right.
No, basically what we did is we wrote a Max script that basically evaluated the models in question and then applied a formula to get to, you know, this vertex maps to this. It was more of a trial and error thing until we got the formula down. Maybe that's something which I'll actually talk to Jeff about posting up on the website, is more information about the actual pipeline. Since we are moving away from this approach, at least you can see what this approach was. But it was, yes, just a mapping from one to the other inside of Max.
Any other questions? No? Okay, thank you. Okay, let me check where we are at time. So let's take a break, 15 minutes, and then we'll come back at 4:30 and start on animation.
All right.